This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The novelist Gary Steingart was born in the Soviet Union in 1971. He was known as Little Igor when he immigrated to the U.S. when he was 7 years old with his parents. They renamed him Gary so he'd suffer one or two fewer beatings at the hands of his new American friends.
That phrase, suffer one or two fewer beatings, is Steingart's own, and it's emblematic of his brand of comedic fiction. Sharp yet twisted, absurd yet painfully truthful. Steingart has put those powers on display in a trio of beloved novels about the immigrant experience, including Super Sad True Love Story and Absurdistan. But what happens when a searingly smart and funny writer's target is himself and his own family? Well, we find out in Steingart's new book, Little Failure, a Memoir. Gary Steingart will be at the Brattle Theater in Cambridge tonight, but he's here in the Radio Boston studios now. Gary Steingart, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
It is fantastic to have you. Let me first start off by asking you about the title of the book, Little Failure.
It was a sweet little nickname my mother came up with when I was in my 20s. I'd graduated from Oberlin College, majoring in the Beatles or whatever. And she, you know, she had always wanted me to go to law school. And then I came out as a writer and I said, look, I'm going to be a writer. And then she visited this apartment I had, which was about 100 square feet in the Lower East Side. And there was a water bug there that was so big, practically my roommate at that point. And she looked around and said, you are a failurechka, which is a combination of English and Russian, failure being failure, and chka being the diminutive, so it becomes little failure. And it stuck, yeah.
And as she told you that, how did you feel?
Well, when you grow up with certain immigrant parents, I think, you know, you take in a, you say, okay, I have failed, and you internalize it for a while, and then you do something with it. Either you drink a lot, or you write a lot of novels, and that's sort of the well, actually, I chose both paths.
I was going to say,
yeah.
Or you do both.
You do both, yeah. A little from column A, a little from column B.
Well, the memoir is truly, it's honest in a way that I think some memoirs are not. And I want to ask you a little bit about why you chose to write one now. I mean, you're not 80 looking back on your life. You're
41.
41, yeah.
But 41, I mean, in Russian years, that's like 67. I mean, we age really quickly. It all, you know, just falls apart. So also, I wanted to remember things. You know, I think I have a very good memory when it comes to childhood. I think Saul Bellow called writers, you know, the great noticers. And I think that's something that I've, every little indignity, but also every little triumph that I've ever had is permanently lodged in my mind. And I wanted to get to it before all those memories faded, because I know they will fade eventually.
So let's hear a little bit of one of those memories, because I want to talk about your parents and their experience coming to America in a moment. But first, focus a little bit on yours. And there's a passage in the book where you talk about one of the miracles of being in America after growing up in the then Soviet Union, which is you wish for something and you can have it here, as in a bicycle. Bicycle, for example.
And not just a bicycle, but in the honeycomb cereal boxes, there came little license plates that you could attach to your bicycle, and they were free when you bought the cereal. This seemed insane. So this is, I guess, the passage. This is 1979. We have just arrived in the United States. I don't have much choice in pals, but there's a one-eyed girl in our building complex whom I have sort of befriended. She's tiny and scrappy and poor just like us. We're suspicious of each other at first, but I'm an immigrant and she has one eye, so we're even. The girl rides around on a half-broken bike just like mine, and she keeps falling and scraping herself. Rumor is that's how she lost her eye. And bawling and bawling whenever her palms get bloodied, her blonde head raised up to the sky. One day she sees me riding my banged-up bicycle with the honeycomb license plate clanging behind me, and she screams, Michigan! Michigan! And I ride ahead, smiling and tooting my bike horn, proud of the English letters that are attached somewhere below my butt. Michigan! Michigan! With its bluish-black license plate, the color of my friend's remaining eye. Michigan! With its delicious American name. How lucky one must be to live there.
That's Gary Steingart reading from his new memoir, Little Failure. And I had, I'm sorry, I had to suppress my laughter as you were reading it, because it is darkly funny. But in, this is a story about your life and your real experience. And quite frankly, as a reader, I don't want to laugh because it's so sad at the same time. Well, I mean, How do you strike that balance between the two?
It's tragicomic, as they say in Hollywood, you know. It's got a little bit of everything. I mean, I think that the life we led was a very funny one. Humor was sort of the last refuge of the SAP, the Soviet Ashkenazi pessimist, and I am one such example. Life was very difficult. It was even more difficult for my parents. You know, they grew up in the Soviet Union. They grew up under Hitler and Stalin, Hitler invading from one side, Stalin killing the rest of the family that wasn't killed off by Hitler, you know. So their lives were just wastelands, but they made something out of it. And the nice thing they did is brought me here right. So that I can formulate my own complaints about life.
Well, I mean, and they brought you here, and yet the community in which you landed in wasn't necessarily fully accepting from the start, though.
Not good being a Russian in 1980, being an ex-Soviet dressed in a giant fur cap with a giant fur coat. All the teachers would take me inside and say, you know, you really should go a little more furless, then the kids will play with you. Good advice for all of life, really, not just for children. But, you know, those years, those old movies, Red Dawn, Red Gerbil, Red Hamster, you know, there was this endless barrage of anti-communism to the point where even in Hebrew school I had to pretend that I was born in East Berlin, not in Leningrad. You know, so here I am in a Hebrew school convincing Jewish kids that I'm a German, you know, which was better than being a Russian.
How was it for your parents then in those early years in New York?
First, it was hard. I mean, English was a problem, obviously, and they did this nice thing that we only spoke Russian in the house. So I got to retain my Russian, which I still speak to this day, but their English didn't improve as much as, you know, nothing's better than having a kid running around screaming in English. But they found the jobs, you know, they found jobs that weren't the usual sort of taxi driver or whatever the Russian engineers did. My father was employed as a mechanical engineer, and they fell in love with this country very much. You know, they still sit around, watch Fox News all day long, and, you know, and they're quite the patriots. I'm, I guess, a little different, you know, I guess.
But tell me a little bit more about your father, though, because there's one point, I want to be sure I have this right. There's one point in the book where your father tells you that he burns with a black envy towards you because he should have been an artist as well, because he had dreamt of being in the opera.
Yeah, he dreamt of being an opera singer. Yes, it's very strange when your father tells you he burns with a black envy toward you. I love the way that sounds in Russian. It's almost operatic in its own right. You know, he loved classical music growing up, and his father was killed when he was just 3 years old. And so for years after that, he hid under his kitchen table, crying, singing opera and classical tunes to himself, and at the same time wishing he could go back in history and kill Hitler so that his own father would live. Mm-hmm. And then he inherited this very violent and unhappy stepfather, and sort of a lot of the tension I have with him goes back, I think, to those days, those horrible days with the stepfather. So anyway, opera is a kind of motif in his life, and I think, I mean, I really wish that he had grown up in a normal country and that his dream, he actually has a very nice voice, and I always dreamt that he could succeed so then he wouldn't have to burn with this black envy.
Well, you know, when I read that, my mind went back to the title of the book, Little Failure, and that your mother may have applied that nickname to you, but little failures seem to dog everybody in their lives.
Right.
In the story of your family.
Well, you know, we so often celebrate the successful immigrants who come to this country and, you know, and run Google and whatnot. And there are many examples of such, but many people don't make it. You know, their dreams don't come true. And all they can think about is how to make their children's dream come true, which is wonderful. But that puts a lot of pressure on the junior immigrant to succeed. And not everyone has that capacity, you know, so there's a lot of expectations all around.
Right. Well, this is something myself as the child of an immigrant parents that I've always wondered, that one of the great ironies of successful immigrant parents, especially from certain cultures, mm-hmm. is that their children do find the capacity to go off and do things that are beyond their parents' original imagination. But that's a sign of their success.
It's a sign of the success, but remember that I think in many immigrant families, the children are seen in many cultures as extensions of their parents, you know. So what they want, who cares what they want? They were brought here for a reason, so go to law school already, you know. So it took a while for my parents to accept. Now they're very proud that I can make a living off this stuff, and as surprising as that is. And that sort of satisfies the immigrant checklist. Okay, he can pay the mortgage. It's okay.
Well, tell us another story to out of the book, because you write, for example, that a lot of America was incredibly confusing in the early years. For example, that you were just very, very befuddled about things like Gilligan's Island.
I couldn't understand. But first of all, we didn't have a television at home. But my grandmother, who lived separately from us, had a television. It was a 1950s Zenith that either showed the picture or you could hear the sound. You could never do both at once. So I wanted to learn all about television because that's all the kids in the playground talked about. So I would watch a show, I would write it down, and then when it was rerun, I would write down the dialogue and then combine the two to form it. It was a good practice for being a writer, actually. But Gilligan Island really surprised me, Gilligan's Island, because, you know, I thought of America as this very powerful country with a very powerful navy, and yet they couldn't find the millionaire and his wife. These two incredibly important personages were missing, you know. That just confused me for a very long time. Still does, actually. What happened?
Actually, yeah, when you wrote it that way and I thought about it, I was like, it really doesn't make any sense.
Imagine Bill Gates goes offshore. I mean, that'd be a huge search party for him.
So it's always interesting when a writer like you, who has really sort of made a mark on American fiction through writing about the immigrant experience, turns that mirror back on himself and his own family's experience. And you've written, for example, that you talked about your other books, and you wrote that, "I went back and reread the three novels I've written, an exercise that left me shocked by the overlaps between fiction and reality I found on those pages and by how blithely I've used the facts of my own life." Why did that surprise you, though?
I just didn't realize to what extent I'd been milking my own life for the fiction I wrote. You know, I mean, all of my novels feature a Russian Jewish nebbish kind of character. I mean, the RJN is my specialty. But I didn't realize to what extent I was relying on past memories that I had suppressed for a very long time, too, because a lot of it is my novels were satires, but there's always a kind of undertone of great rage and unhappiness in them. And what the memoir did, I think, in some ways for me was, and I'm not saying one should write a memoir for its therapeutic qualities, God knows, but, you know, in my 20s, I had a kind of anger and a rage toward a lot of things, toward Hebrew school, but also toward my parents for being the very hard, tough immigrant parents that they were. But in finishing this book and in going back to Russia with my parents and exploring certain things, I realized all that feelings had been sort of changed to just this incredible sorrow, this unhappiness that not for myself, but for them, that they got the really raw deal. You know, we're talking about my father's opera career, but it's really all around. They could never fulfill themselves because they came to this country at such a young age and because they grew up in such a terrible country.
Well, you write about what that really means with a kind of clarity, which gives us insight into like really intimate and painful and personal parts of your life, though. I mean, for example, you write about how sometimes your father used to hit you.
Sure. Yeah. No. Well, you know, it's, again, this sounds terrible to American ears, but there is a cultural component here where if you grew up in Leningrad, and especially if you had a violent stepfather and your kid got out of line, you hit that kid, especially if it was a boy. That sounds terrible. It would obviously not something I would repeat with my own son. But that was a country without social services barging in on the door whenever somebody got hit, because then social services would be very busy, you know. I mean, how many times did Vladimir Putin get hit as a child? And look at him now.
Yeah. Well, you know, one reviewer has written about your book that that really what little failure your memoir is in part it's a love story about the love between a father and his son. I mean, do you think that that's an accurate portrayal of one of the core parts of this book?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is a love story. I mean, it didn't really start out as one. And, you know, when I started writing it, it was more this kind of meditation on what it means to be a son. But by the end of it, I think I kind of got it. I got it. And I realized that in some ways, you know, my father is bigger than me, but even bigger than him is the history that's sort of the father of us all. You know, there's this unbelievable history that's very hard to outrun. And in America, we always think there's a second act and we can always become something different. Fitzgerald slightly disproves that. But I really think it's very hard to do that. It's very hard for me. You know, I mean, things have worked out wonderfully for me, much better than I'd ever hoped. But there's a little compartment where a little failure still fits the bill. You know, that stuff never fully changes.
Well, we've been talking a lot about your father, but tell me more about your mother and her experience coming to America and being in this foreign land.
Well, she was always very social and much more adaptable. I always think of her for some reason as a woman from the American South, you know, very gracious. And but at the same time, you know, she was she came from also a very difficult family. This is the kind of family that had a photo album entitled Uncle So-and-So and His Children Buried Alive in Belarus, 1943. You know, this is not exactly our vacation in Cape Cod. It was, you know, brutal, brutal upbringing. Our entire family destroyed by Hitler and then by Stalin as well. So, and the stories she tells are incredible. You know, her father bought her a balalaika for 2 rubles, and her mother. This was when people were starving in Leningrad, and her mother took it and smashed it against the wall to prove a point to his father, and she started to cry. And the mother said, well, I know you're crying not because you lost your instrument, but because you know how much it affects me, and you're that sensitive. Huh. You know, so that was the lesson learned from there. And wow, you know, I'm just,
yeah.
It almost brought me to tears when she said, when she tells me these stories, and she doesn't quite reflect on the fact that she doesn't take time not to feel pity for herself, but just to understand that it was a traumatic experience for a little kid to have that happen to her.
Well, so that's one of the things that I wonder about, because now you're telling us through the book these same stories. Right. And I mean, you said that you've promised yourself that, you know, previously through fiction, you would sort of approach these issues and then run to safety, as you've said, but that this time around there would be no safety. And yet it's not just you. What about the shelter that your fiction provided your family, because it wasn't really about them?
Well, yes, it wasn't really about them. It's true. No, and there's a worry, obviously, on my part. Am I exposing too much? Am I telling too much? But then the problem is this, then no memoir should be written, because in the way I approach it, if this is going to be just another one of those glorifications and kind of almost taking away people's humanity by glorifying them, the immigrant comes, she sees, she conquers, everything's great, you know, all of a sudden the pension plan rolls in. That's not what I wanted to do. And once I started writing the real truth, then I decided it had to be that, you know, no matter what consequence.
You've dedicated this book to your parents. Have they read it?
I sent them a copy. In their defense, they don't read English as well as they read Russian. So once, hopefully, a Russian translation comes along, then they can read it and put together a litany of complaints, I hope.
They will be your most honest critics,
that's
I'm
true.
Sure.
I'm sure.
Well, Gary Steingart will be at the Brattle Theater tonight for a Harvard Bookstore event beginning at 6 p.m. His new wonderful memoir is called Little Failure. There's an excerpt of it at our website, radioboston.org. Gary Steingart, a true pleasure to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.